Okay, sir. From Korea, you were transferred back to Fort Sam Houston. And I'm sure this was a much better assignment than being back at Fort Polk.
Yes, yeah. It was. It was also a good assignment, again, from a personal standpoint and career standpoint, because I was having the opportunity to go to the advanced career course, which is the second phase, basically, for young officers after their basic training, then going to the advanced course. If you don't have the opportunity of going to that, typically you're not going to progress through the military at all. It was also a time that I could be with my family on a good installation with the friends that I started out in the basic course with, and other pilots and their wives and families. And we truly were there, number one, to, I guess, get our ticket punched, as they say it, but also to experience and share what each one of us had been through in the different assignments. And that is one good thing about the career course and the format that they had. They wanted active participation from the students to talk about what the trend was in the units, wherever they might be located, in Europe, or Asia, or in Latin America, or whatever. And from that, much of our doctrine could, in fact, be changed based on feedback that they were receiving from students in the career course. So it was a very engaging, active participation, both from the instructor standpoint, but from the student standpoint. We were able to clearly voice our opinions on typically what was happening in our specific training as officers, may it be logistics, registrar, personnel, hospital administration, whatever it might be. The other good thing about the advanced course, many, as I saw in 68, one of the assignments that the non-aviators were able to get is go back to the school and become instructors in the training classes on the platform. That gave a good perspective because many of these officers were lieutenants or first lieutenants in the service when they went to Vietnam, and they experienced both the ground activity and the air activity and had a great appreciation of what was happening at the time. So I think almost all the thoughts that were being expressed in that particular school were helpful to some of the students that had never been to a combat assignment, being able to hear what experiences they had encountered in performing their duties and responsibilities, and what the current doctrine might say in the textbook and what we had revolved to in the real world, yet it hadn't been written yet in the textbook. So that whole six-month period of time of training, I think, was excellent from a military standpoint, understanding what was going on, and possibly even touching upon what the people on the platform felt that the government or the political establishment felt and was trying to do with the services.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they obviously had to a specific script they had to talk from, but I think at least we were hearing what was being published
mm-hmm.
from a governmental standpoint
mm-hmm.
of what was occurring and what would occur in the future.
How much did that training come into play when you went back to Vietnam in 1970?
I think all training helps from, again, a common sense standpoint
mm-hmm.
of, and also giving you the material or the knowledge to look for things once something happened.
Mm-hmm.
Did you change your way of doing things? You probably changed your way of how you looked at things
mm-hmm.
more so than how you made changes mm-hmm. to what you were doing
mm-hmm.
Specifically in a unit.
Mm-hmm.
It gave you more confidence to deal with issues. Now, from a flying standpoint, I felt it had no effect
okay.
because it was not geared towards aviation training.
Right.
Now, there was a course, though, shortly after the advanced course
mm-hmm.
that was built for pilots and senior medical people to go through. And one of the things that we had felt as pilots in the first tour and others had seen in Korea
mm-hmm.
was that we as pilots were not specifically trained well enough to give direction and guidance to our medics
mm-hmm.
if they needed help on medication or treatment.
Right.
So, again, I participated in a pilot program
mm-hmm.
of, number one, giving feedback to the instructors that were going to teach the course
mm-hmm.
and then participating in a pilot training program, which continued throughout the Vietnam era,
okay.
of giving more pharmacology to pilots,
mm-hmm.
Giving more emergency rescue treatment to pilots, giving many other things that related to medical care of patients under emergency situations, and how to cope with those emergency situations
mm-hmm.
with the available equipment that you had in the aircraft.
Right.
Now, that was a short 2-week program,
mm-hmm.
but it was, I think it was 2 weeks. It was very compact, very intense, with a lot of requirements, just about flying medical evacuation helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
But now some of that training extended even well beyond the military for me
mm-hmm.
that I've used in emergency situations mm-hmm. later on. So it was more like a emergency medical technician a training,
mm-hmm.
CPR, emergency tracheotomy,
mm-hmm.
those kinds of things that I later used.
Okay.
So I thought that was a school that was adapted very quickly of the need and executed to all pilots that were going into a short-term, mm-hmm. A short tour in Vietnam.
Both of these training courses came before you were assigned to Hunter Army Airfield in Georgia, is that correct?
Right, and then I had the third course, which was a material management logistics course
mm-hmm.
that was a four-month course before I was assigned to Hunter Stewart. And the reason I was assigned to Hunter Stewart was because I went to the material management course at the first part of that year.
Okay.
before being assigned.
Okay.
And my reason then was I knew the writing on the wall that I could not be a pilot forever, and I wanted to move in the direction so I could go into a healthcare hospital installation setting and eventually become a hospital administrator.
Right.
So it was my thought at that time. And again, I insisted that I go to the course. I was a pain in their butt wanting advanced training so that I could sort of start a parallel track.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by doing that, I was kind of resisting the establishment because at that time, they wanted only one parallel track.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened to be aviation. That's where they had put their money. And they wanted me to continue that road. But at Hunter Stewart was one of the aviation training installations that helped supplement Rucker. That's where all the Cobra training was going on for the new aircraft. And it was all aviation units at Hunter Stewart. So when I went there, I was going to, number one, a material management hospital position as an associate administrator, but I was also in a flying slot. So I was able to get both worlds and had both opportunities to continue my flying and keeping my proficiency and also being a material management officer. I was able to use the aircraft to fly along with two other pilots that happened to be on that staff, evacuation of patients, again, like Fort Polk, moving patients from one civilian hospital to a military hospital. And I did that quite a bit.
Okay.
Now, the person that was in charge of that hospital happened to be William Bentley, Lieutenant Colonel William Bentley, that I had first run across when I was training at the 498, and he was one of the assistant operations officers. So this was my second assignment with a particular person that I had a great deal of admiration for. After spending a very exciting tour where I really felt that I was doing more than just flying a helicopter. I was doing skills as an administrator at that particular hospital. And Colonel Bentley gave me a lot of opportunities where I guess I could have failed or succeeded. And I had a successful tour there.
Okay.
But unfortunately, what I had hoped that I would avoid by going to Korea, assignment officer called me one day and said, it's your time to go to Vietnam. Of course, my first question to him was, who has not been to Vietnam yet?
Right.
And, of course, there were still some scalawags that were avoiding it somehow or other, either because of medical reasons or rotation or of assignments or a critically needed person in a particular position that they couldn't afford to move. But I went ahead and took the assignment, obviously, and I've always taken all of the assignments, I think, with a very positive attitude because I always benefited for each one of them. So on the 4th of July, I arrived in Vietnam for my second tour.
Now, how did you feel coming back in the country, you know, for the second time, coming back into this, I mean, a much, much different situation on the ground from March of 1964 when you first arrived to July 1970?
Well, the first thing was that when I went the first time, I was the second lieutenant. I had just been promoted to major about 4 months prior to going to Vietnam, my second tour. So I had And my anxiety was that, number one, I most likely was going to be a commander. Mm-hmm. And I many flashbacks of the commander that I had that was killed in Vietnam, my first tour. Even if I was a executive officer as a young major, if I got there and the assignment was that all of them were filled, I wasn't going to be the commander but the executive officer. That position weighed an awful lot on every soldier, every pilot, every person in the unit, and it also affected the image of Dustoff with all the support units that we had. So I had a great deal of anxiety that I had the Dustoff reputation that I had to live up to, of which I probably created part of that reputation in the previous tour. I got there. It was surely not the fanfare of my first assignment when Major Kelly and Paul Bloomquist met me at the airfield and escorted me from the aircraft to their jeep while it was parked on the runway and whisked me off to my unit. I arrived in Vietnam the second tour. They had no idea where they were going to put me. They had no idea which unit I would go to. And I basically was in the holding detachment for assignment for at least a day before they finally decided where I would go.
Where did you fly into?
I flew into Tonsonu, or Saigon, initially. That was, where most of the most everyone came in the country at. But once I got assignment, I got an assignment to Chu Lai, and I was told that I would be the commander of a detachment there. I didn't realize, and I don't think they realized until I got there, that the arrangement was that the senior pilot or the commander would not only be the detachment commander for the assignment that I was going to, but I'd also be a detachment commander for the other detachment, too. So I assumed command of the 54th Detachment and the 68th Med Detachment located in Chu Lai. On or about July the 5th or somewhere like that.
How would you gauge the morale of the men when you arrived?
Well, first off, the first thing I noticed right away was, number one, we had 12 aircraft. They had an absolutely wonderful compound by themselves. They all had separate and independent living quarters. My living quarters was on a bluff over the Red China Sea with about a 90-foot drop-off to the sand below. And I had a living room, a master bedroom, and a guest room with a full kitchen and bar.
Wow. That's a
so
huge difference.
It surely was not like my first tour.
Absolutely.
Where I had about an 8x10 space with one cot and a desk and a closet. I found out that Chu Lai, the people that had been there before, were really knew how to live it up. And they had a wonderful compound. We had great support. The people that were there still were some of them on their first tour. I did go there and replaced the commander that had been there and had been moved for one reason or another, I knew that right away that I needed to fly at night because there was very little flying being performed at night.
Mm-hmm.
That immediately changed. I put myself up every night so that I could fly with the pilots and crews, and number one, initiate some loyalty or esprit with the pilots, because they had felt that flying was not a shared duty,
mm-hmm.
or responsibility with some of their leaders.
Okay. Were you expected as the commander to do your time flying, or was that unusual?
No. I think, well, let me, from my viewpoint,
uh-huh.
all commanders should be willing to fly just like any other pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is not necessarily the way that some people view that position.
Mm-hmm.
But in a combat situation, you've got to lead by example. We had a lot of warrant officers. We had very few officers that had other responsibilities like supply and logistics. One thing that I noticed also that unfortunately was occurring then in Vietnam, wasn't occurring in the first tour,
mm-hmm.
that they were getting inspected just like units in the United States were, IG inspections,
mm-hmm.
maintenance inspections, all of those kinds of distractors that I personally did not feel that were appropriate in a combat zone. But we had to do them,
mm-hmm.
and we did well. The people did absolutely fantastic,
okay.
and we did well on the CMMIs. We got the highest scores in the division.
Mm-hmm.
We had to do well in the IGs, and we did that. And we were flying an awful lot with young warrants and young officers. And I say young. I was the major, and then the one of my commanders of the 68th was a first lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
and he was the next senior person in both units.
Mm.
And then everybody else was either second lieutenants or warrant officers.
Okay.
Now you'd wonder where those other 300 officers were,
mm-hmm.
that are in the medical service corps.
Yes.
But again, opinion statement.
Mm-hmm. Which helicopter were you flying at this point?
We were flying then the H model.
Mm-hmm.
It had more power. We were flying all kind. We were flying quite a few missions.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I was at Chu Lai, just in a short period of time, and I think I was there from July 4th until November 7th.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the 4th of November 1970,
mm-hmm.
Our unit with 12 aircraft flew almost 4,300 missions,
mm.
and we flew a little over 10,000. It was 10,163 patients with the 54th and 68th, and they were almost every one of them Americans.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big difference.
Mm-hmm.
My first tour, when I flew 750 missions,
mm-hmm.
Just myself,
mm-hmm.
and 2,248 patients, almost every one of those were Arvin.
Right.
Those are my, I'm mixing units statistics and individual statistics.
Mm-hmm.
But without a question, we were evacuated, and we had not two ships up during the daytime, but three and four ships. And we were flying, our missions had changed from an hour and 30 minutes to 2 hours,
mm-hmm.
to 15 minutes to 30 minutes at the longest duration,
mm-hmm.
For any of our pickups.
Okay.
So, I mean, we were flying hot quick turnaround missions.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the 54th and the 68th did have a good reputation as far as not losing any aircraft or people.
Okay. How did transferring Americans this time, evacuating Americans, affect you, or did it affect you, versus airlifting out Arvin troops earlier?
I kept the same basic, mindset that the people that I was, I turned them into cordwood or
mm-hmm.
wood
mm-hmm.
or just supplies, and I really avoided identity of people.
Mm-hmm.
I just did not think of it.
Mm-hmm.
The only time I lost one crew, at least a crew was killed when I was the commander there. And unfortunately, it was a freak accident. One of those spotter helicopters, a loach, they call them,
mm-hmm.
Was doing low-level terrain, trying to snoop out the enemy to draw fire. We had just, this particular crew had made a pickup in an LZ and was coming out of the LZ, and this loach hit their aircraft from the backside, and they both fell, and our crew was decapitated from the loach's blades coming inside the cockpit and the back of the aircraft.
Mm.
And that accident shouldn't have occurred, but
mm-hmm.
it did.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had to go and identify the lieutenant and the warrant officer
mm-hmm.
and the medic and the crew chief, I remember that extremely well
mm-hmm.
Because it truly was personal. And the only other time that had occurred was when I picked up my commander at 64.
Right.
And that broke through my shell, and I hated, I guess because the bodies were maimed so badly,
mm-hmm.
I hated to open up the body bag and identify
mm-hmm.
The lieutenant.
How much did that affect the rest of the unit there?
It's a devastating loss. And just going through the process of the memorial service and the closeness of the unit, it's
mm-hmm.
it's truly like taking a brother or a sister from you
mm-hmm.
And you didn't get to say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a devastating thing. I think, though, if you're a loose unit, you don't survive those incidents as well. I think if your men are dedicated to the mission and the esprit and the history of Dust-Off
mm-hmm.
or the unit,
mm-hmm.
Then they have a stronger desire to continue on and do a better job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't due to a lack of skill of the crew that came to create their demise. It was just two aircraft meeting in air where they didn't expect it.
Right.
But during that period of time, all of our crews demonstrated how we could fly and did fly, and many of the tactics that I learned in my first tour, I tried to share with, and I did. It was my responsibility to
mm-hmm.
share the flying techniques that had not been being used in those two units mm-hmm. when I first arrived.
Were those tactics still applicable?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Even though the terrain was different,
mm-hmm.
We had triple canopy up in July.
Mm-hmm.
We were using the hoist a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And we were experiencing greater firepower in the Chulai area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Chulai, the AmeriCal division, you know,
mm-hmm.
That's where the My Lai incident occurred.
Yes, sir.
Prior to my time there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always a discussion of contact with the forces on the ground. They tried never, the AmeriCal division encountering the enemy, tried to go through the rules of engagement on everything that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And by going through the rules of engagement, they may have lost soldiers, because they had to be fired upon before they could return fire.
Mm-hmm.
Our ships had to be fired upon before we could return fire. And, you know, whoever pulls the trigger first has an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
You still with me?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Why do you think those rules of engagement were so prevalent there in Vietnam? Do you think the United States had simply not learned from its previous 5, 6, 7 years there? Or were we trying to get out and be cautious?
When we go through the rules of engagement,
mm-hmm.
what we're trying to do is ensure that we do not have political embarrassment or review of the action after the action has occurred,
mm-hmm.
which would generate criticism to the commanders and the people on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So the rules of engagement were truly a hindrance, in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
In improving the life expectancy of people on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
The gunships and we did trickery, I guess. We would send the Lochow, the sniff ship, the little one-manned helicopter, to draw fire from the enemy so that we could unleash the gunships on who fired at us.
Mm-hmm.
If we were going into a hot LZ, and we knew it was hot, we could not get fire suppression until the gunships heard ground fire, or the ground people said we were being fired upon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typically, when you're being fired upon, you know it because you hear the bullet or bullets breaking the sound barrier when they're in close proximity of you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's typically the only way you know you're getting fired upon, unless it's showing evidence of something breaking inside the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I've said all I need to say about rules of engagement. I may not have answered your question. I'm not trying to avoid it. I just don't know what else to say about it.
No, I understand your answer very clearly. I've heard that from a number of veterans, a complaint. And I'm wondering, you're there again in 1970, 71. What was the climate in country among American troops like? I guess, you know, you've commented on your unit, but what about the other units you had contact with?
Well, they were, for example, if we were on a compound and the AmeriCal division in Chulai had a huge, enormous complex to handle an aviation unit, all the combat forces of a division, 25,000 people, you can, the perimeter is huge. Much of the perimeter was by a sea perimeter. So people could, and there was no real protection by sea. But, yes, we had outpost guards. They were on 24 hours a day. We had ships running the perimeter with lights on at night. But if they weren't fired upon, they couldn't fire at anything.
Right.
And we'd get rocket attacks that they could launch 25 rockets in a matter of a few minutes and be out of there before we could respond. Because we weren't, we were more in a defensive posture than an offensive posture. And if we were in an offensive posture, we could have probably beat them to the punch and eliminated the enemy. And I'm talking way out of my realm of expertise, because I really had never had to fire at anybody that often. I don't think I've ever killed anybody. So I'm saying it from a different perspective than a ground force. But I felt that they were hampered immensely by encountering the enemy.
Did you hear this complaint a lot?
Yes.
Okay.
All the time.
Okay.
And their soldiers, I felt the troops were frightened of that. They that was an unknown out there that was always waiting. Of course, that's the type of battle we were in. I mean, when you were in the jungle, you didn't know what was in front of you. But nobody liked to be point.
Right. What did you think of the Vietnamization policy that was going on at the time you were there?
I don't think it was effective at all.
Okay.
I think that I think the entire Vietnamization program was lip service. I think that I think the people that were trying to do the Vietnamization program did not have enough faith in the people to do it, and they may not have had that capability. They may have deduced that themselves by working with them. But from standing from the peripheral side of things, I don't think they had they did not have the will. The people did not have the will. They've been fighting so long that it, they had compromised their will to live.
Had your opinion changed of Vietnam itself and the Vietnamese civilian population when you went back?
I never, now first off, I never felt, the people that I came encountered with, the people that were wounded, the people that were taking care of the wounded, I think they were doing as much as they could. And I don't think American forces could have done a better job other than they were trained better and they had more resources to use.
Okay.
So I didn't have a disrespect for the Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to get off base any?
Yes.
What would you do when you would go off base?
In Sac Trang, the only thing I would do was go and get some photographs developed, but and talk to a few merchants in downtown Sac Trang.
Mm-hmm.
And they were always, obviously, I was a customer, and they always tried to treat me with respect, and they always did a good job at whatever they were doing. They were very artistic, kind, humble, gracious people. And if they had, if they were having dinner or lunch, they'd want me to sit down and eat with them.
Mm-hmm.
So they give the shirt off their back to you as a people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we want to talk about the government and how third world countries are and how they had a personal agenda and not necessarily a country agenda to protect their people, I think that's two different groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
You had the government officials, and then you had the poor and needy.
Mm-hmm.
There were two classes of people.
Mm-hmm.
One class was a very powerful, small class of selected few. And then you had the masses.
Mm-hmm.
And the masses suffered.
Do you think the masses cared either way, which way their government would go?
No.
Okay.
They just wanted to be at peace. They wanted to have their family survive. They wanted to be left alone. And they were caught up in battle.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the media coverage of the war?
I'm going to only relate to one person.
Okay.
Jim Lucas, who was a noted author. He reported for the Associated Press. He wrote one book by the name of Vietnam Dateline, and he published numerous daily articles of what was going on in the field with American soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
He did a very good job because he was there on the ground, flying with or walking with are seeing and experiencing and smelling and feeling a daily war.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a prize winner in the Korean War, and I don't know what his publishing accomplishments were in the Vietnam War. But I knew him personally. So that's a personal opinion of the gentleman that reported factual information and did not distort the facts. The rest of the...
Go ahead.
The rest of the media I don't feel reported the true happenings that were occurring in Vietnam, and they only wrote in line with how to sell the newspapers or how to sell the magazines, which is their job. They have to sell news, but different motive, and that's all I have to say about the newspaper or media.
Okay. Did you see a lot of drug or alcohol use on your second tour?
No. Not in aviation units.
Okay.
Not in our units, because we had random tests. We were our crews could not be on flying status or be with our unit if they were caught.
Okay.
Did we have some drug use in our unit? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We had I know of one incident with a enlisted person that was in the coke pretty heavy.
Okay.
But it was a strict abiding by requirement with aviation units that we had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after I finished Chulai,
mm-hmm.
I was summoned to the 61st Med Battalion for one reason or another,
mm-hmm.
Probably because I kept giving my battalion commander of the 61st Med Battalion trouble by not listening to him sometimes and having telephone difficulty and obviously not hearing what he was telling me.
Mm-hmm.
But I did have the opportunity of moving down to Quinyon
mm-hmm.
with the 61st Med Battalion. I became the operations officer for the battalion. Now, that was quite a coup because I was a junior major and we had multiple other detachments and companies that had senior people over me. So I did take over that responsibility. I had responsibility of overseeing 55 medical helicopters in six geographic areas. And we also had the ground evacuation assets for I Corps
mm-hmm.
and Northern Military Region 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, and we covered the area all the way up to the DMZ down to Tuiwai, south
mm-hmm.
of Quinyon. And I stayed in that position up until February, working for Francis A. Copeland. Just before Francis A. Copeland left, I took over as the executive officer, the number two guy in the Corps for aviation.
Mm-hmm. This is February 1971, right?
Yes, in 1971.
Okay.
But shortly, of course, right before Francis A. Copeland left, Francis A. Copeland I had met for the first time. He was then a lieutenant colonel in 71. I had met him as a major when he came into country with the 82nd. And he was one of the old-timers, but he had certain thoughts and ideas that he preferred that everybody do.
Mm-hmm.
So I really and truly had to keep my mouth shut as much as I could
mm-hmm.
and do what I needed to do to be the executive officer and also the operations officer for that battalion. But things ended up well. Actually, I was rated quite well there. But the guy that came into my life again for the third time was William Bentley,
hmm.
Colonel Bentley.
Mm-hmm.
He had been at the 498th and then at Tuttle Community Hospital in Hunter Stewart, and
mm-hmm.
now he was my battalion commander.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with him for some time, continued, actually it was only a short period of time, about 2 months, and on February 25th, 1971, Bill Bentley came in, he first told me, he said, Ernie, your wife Beth is just absolutely going to hate me for what I have to ask you to do. And I realized what he was going to tell me at the time because up in Phu Bai and Quang Tri, we had been having a lot of feedback from the ground general officer and the group commander, which was over us, that pilots were refusing to fly, and that we were into a very, very large operation. And he asked that I go up there and take over the three units. They're the 236, the 237th, and the 571st medical detachments, aviation detachments, and make sure that we change the opinion of the dust-off support with the 5th Mechanized Division. At least there was a brigade up there that was supporting Lomsom 719. And what was occurring, again, the two commanders that were there had been relieved by the group commander, and I basically was able to select from the 55 different aircraft, or actually the 110 pilots that we had in our battalion, I could pick, handpick any pilot that I wanted to assist in that operation, which I did. And I took the people that probably had more brass on their body than some and were willing to fly in the hot missions and liked to fly. So I basically reestablished the personnel strength that we had there in Fubai and Quang Tri. What I discovered was that many of the just simple things on a daily basis were not happening, which had always happened in dust-off units, typically, that I'd known. And that was, for example, first thing, getting up early break in the morning and pre-flighting your aircraft and getting it ready for the very first mission. And I found that there were people, pilots, that were not doing that and didn't see any need in it. And it really was an unfortunate situation in that there had been total lack of leadership and guidance and leading by example in those three detachments. And we were getting people killed because of that. And we had probably, unfortunately, the hottest, largest mission ever to take place in Vietnam. And that was in Lomsom 719. We had to go deep into Laos. We had to fly with gunships and fixed-wing Air Force jets on almost all of our missions. The intensity of the fire in Lomsom 719 far exceeded anything that I've ever seen in my lifetime as far as fire on rescue mission, rescue ships. If you flew too high, you would have SAM missiles being fired at you. If you flew on the deck, which we were trained to do, and we had plenty of mountains there, we would get fired from above, from the mountains above, and a layer of lead would be being fired up from below of small arms fire. And if we got into the LZ, the compounds that were 30 miles from the border, we could not stay on the ground but about 3 seconds. We'd count the three and pull pitch. If we got into the compound, And if we stayed longer than that, we would be barraged with mortars and be nailed while we were on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
How
many times would was your aircraft hit? Every time?
My aircraft was never hit.
Okay.
But the aircraft that were hit, we lost, let's see, I've got something here that can help me.
Mm-hmm. Did you take small arms fire every time?
We took small arms fire. I need to take a break real quick.
Okay.
Sir. It won't take me but just a moment.
Go ahead, sir.
I wanted to continue on about the type of environment that we were flying in.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to express also a feeling that I had in that I wanted, when I picked the individuals, soldiers, pilots, and crew even, mm-hmm. they had to be, number one, all volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
After I chose them, I asked them if they wanted to do the job. And I knew full well that they would.
Mm-hmm.
But what I also knew that these pilots typically were able to get into LZs and get out of LZs with the best probability of success.
Okay.
And I picked some pilots that had been there the second time, and they had a great deal of experience of flying. And the ones that I brought up from Chulai just absolutely did not concern themselves with what was around them as far as hostility,
mm-hmm.
and were able to keep a present of mind with themselves at all times, and were able to take care of the crew and the evacuation people at all times.
Okay.
So I was looking for success. Now, we supported Lam Sam 719 from two locations, from Quang Tri, which is right up on the DMZ,
mm-hmm.
and from Phu Bai. Now, Phu Bai was where our detachments typically were at.
Mm-hmm.
I had to move all my aircraft forward, though, to Quang Tri, and then I had aircraft field sighted right within 5 miles of the border.
Mm-hmm.
And let me talk about the package that we had to use.
Okay.
Went into Laos.
Okay.
We were required by the 5th Mechanized that we would always have a gun package go in with us. That was at least two Cobras going in with each aircraft that we went in,
mm-hmm.
with. The second thing that we did that we had never done in my history, other than with the 82nd, when the 82nd had come in and they wanted to fly an additional ship, which we stopped because we felt there was too much flying. But due to the hostilities, we wanted to be able to have a cover dust-off aircraft above the primary dust-off that was going in to pick up the patients in case we were shot down.
Mm-hmm.
They would be able to swoop in, hopefully within moments, pick us up and get us out,
mm-hmm.
before the enemy overwhelmed our position. On later into the event of Lam Sam 719, when all the compounds were being overrun and any armaments that we were being put into these compounds out in Laos were being annihilated by direct contact with tanks and huge numbers of North Vietnamese. First, it created a dilemma that we knew that they were all surrounded. Mm-hmm. We also knew that when we put our ship down on the ground, that everybody that was in that compound that could walk would want to come out. Mm-hmm. So when we'd go into these sites, we would have 20 to 30 people trying to get on the aircraft. Mm-hmm. We had to use force on many occasions to push the patients or the people that were on the ground away from the aircraft to pull off. Mm-hmm. And we had to do that or we would be overloaded and unable to pull out of the LZs. Mm-hmm. And they were overcrowding the ships. And in the 3 seconds that we were on the ground, in mass numbers, we did have a lot of missions. In the missions, we had 1,231 missions in the Bomsan 719 operation. Mm-hmm. 735 of them were deep into Laos. What really makes it bad is that we had 53 hoist missions in hot LZs, mm-hmm. where people had rockets being launched at them. They had small arm fire. They had quad 50s. They had radar control weapons being fired at them. We had, we classified that out of the 735 missions in the Laos, mm-hmm. we had 147 bad missions. I mean, that's where the pilots and the crew really did not think they'd make it out. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what the criteria in those days were, other than our ships were taking a lot of fire, mm-hmm. not necessarily hits. But in Lomsom 719, we had 2,382 sorties. Of those, 1,460 sorties were in the Laos. Okay. We had a total of flying hours, 1,126 flying hours. 687 of those were in Laos. Okay. Now, patients evacuated. We evacuated 1,007 Americans. Now, the Americans weren't supposed to be on the ground. So
right.
What that is are crews that we picked up that had been shot down.
Okay.
Total patients evacuated out of there were 4,139 patients. Now, of that, 3,133 were Arvin patients. We so that gives you a feel for that. Now, what did it cost to our aircraft? We lost almost 24% of our aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Are these the dust off losses or in general U.S.?
No, that's just dust off.
Okay,
that's out of 18 aircraft that we had in actually. 12 aircraft that were in direct support of Lomsom 719. We had 6 aircraft that were just backhauling, and they were fairly safe. But 9 aircraft were individually hit. 8 aircraft were lost out of those 9 individual aircraft that were hit. But we still were able to maintain a 76% availability of the aircraft that we had.
That's great.
We unfortunately had 6 KIAs of crews and 9 wounded during this intense fire. Mm-hmm. We had 69 hits, which are not very many because one of the few times I was hit in another year, I got as many as 21 hits. Mm-hmm. So it could be a significant burst. But the evacuation at the end of the Lomsom 719 was so bad that we would have the aircraft going in, the dust off. We had a platoon or company worth of gunships on either side of us. We let them go out in front of us, and in front of them we had fighter jets napalming and bombing the areas around the compound before we got there and laying down scraping fire. And we fly down the corridor between the gunships on either side of us, laying down fire, and we were still taking intense fire. And to have this many aircraft survive was significant in itself.
Absolutely.
But I just cannot express how intense this operation was.
What kind of toll
did it lose the crew that we did lose? We did have one medic. His crew was down in the compound because too many people were climbing on board the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't get the aircraft out. Mortars hit the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
It took us several days to get him out. His name was Spec 4 Fuji. He was a medic. He was eventually, right after the operation, awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for saving all kinds of Arvin's lives and many American lives while he was on the ground. And he even directed artillery on his position so that he'd
mm-hmm.
keep the Viet Cong or North Vietnamese off of him.
Mm-hmm.
So there were quite a few outstanding crews that flew and kept the aircraft flying during all types of conditions, fog, rain, and heavy fire.
Mm-hmm.
We were evacuating to multiple locations. The first of the 5th Infantry Mechanized had a 100-bed facility we were evacuating into. Then we had three Arvin hospitals at the 1st Division TOC. One was the 712th Medical Company. It was 50 beds. Then we had the 1st Infantry Division, 30 beds. And then the 1st Airborne Division, 20 beds.
Okay.
I have a list of the number of combat divisions that we were up against in Laos from the North Vietnamese standpoint. They are part of my notes that I have provided. You might want to review those,
mm-hmm.
or I can attach those at another time.
Okay. How did this mission affect you personally? What kind of toll did it take upon you?
I think I was most concerned about the crews and trying to keep them alert and willing to fly. They were taking, initially when I got there, they were taking a lot of abuse, verbal abuse from the commanding general of the 1st of the 5th,
mm-hmm.
because the 1st of the 5th had seen us waver. And in my opinion, we had, in my experience, had never wavered
mm-hmm.
In doing the dust-off mission. And we surely had fallen short of what standards I had been taught in my first year of Vietnam with Major Kelly and Pat Brady and many other brave people that I had the opportunity of flying with.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you just have to instill confidence in every person that's in your unit, and you have to spend personal time with them, and you have to also spend personal time in the cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an aviator and a leader, you've just got to do that.
Mm-hmm. It seems that one constant theme in your service in Vietnam and really in your career is that you led by example.
I hope that that's what I've done. and I hope it was ended up being positive. I preach that theme. I just hope that what I've said is what I did. I think overall, I can people would say that's what it was, but I just don't know how any else way to do it.
After Lamsung 719 was completed, you were then sent to Da Nang. Is that correct?
Right, and okay. And Bill Bentley did that at that point in time. We were beginning to consider consolidating the resources that we had. He was also probably wanting to get me out of the field. Mm-hmm. He made me, at that time, aviation staff officer for the group. He just didn't want me to get in harm's way. Mm-hmm. I guess he had an obligation to my wife, Beth, make sure I got home. So I spent a little bit of time there, and I brought basically what we had done at the 61st Med Battalion, mm-hmm. and instituted it at the group. And I worked for directly Colonel Bethea, who was the group commander, mm-hmm. Who actually had relieved the people in the operation prior to me arriving to support the units in Fubai and Quang Tre. Mm-hmm. So I think overall they could appreciate what had been accomplished in a short period of time when we were there. Mm-hmm. But if you do, I really would like for you to take an opportunity of going to several of the chapters leading up to this that I'd written. Mm-hmm. Chapter 23 and chapter 24 and chapter 25 of my notes, mm-hmm. that I've broken out by month, basically, or periods, in my diary that you have there at the school, mm-hmm. Would be, I guess, worth reviewing in more detail.
Of course, I'll definitely do that, sir. So, did you know in July 71 that was your date to leave Vietnam?
Yes.
Okay. And I can assume, I'm sure, that you were quite happy to get out of country at that point.
I was very happy, and I was apprehensive, as I said before, mm-hmm. when I went over, because I was older. Mm-hmm. And you view things differently when you're a little bit older. Mm-hmm. Now, in 71, let's see, I was at that time 31 years old. Mm-hmm. In 70, went over, I was 30. I was seasoned, though, and I felt that my experience would keep me out of harm's way, but I also knew that I had an obligation to lead, as you say, by example. And I knew that I was going to do that, and I knew I was going to put myself in a position whereby the probability of being injured was higher. Mm-hmm.
Did you keep the level of danger that you were in, especially on the second tour, away from Beth and your family?
I never, ever told them the experience. And even in my diary, I did not keep that. I kept events, and I kept flying hours, but I did not add the personal feelings or the personal concerns I had about my well-being. I never wrote that. I didn't think it was necessary.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about that, about your overall experience in Vietnam. What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned while there?
I think the most significant, and again, this is from a shallow viewpoint, mm-hmm. was that communications was absolutely unequivocally the most important thing that a person could generate between parties, not only from an officer standpoint, but from an enlisted standpoint. Now, I've used that traditionally throughout my entire career, both as a business owner and in the military, of communicating at all levels with every person within an organization, and also trying to communicate with every contact that could affect or influence the mission that my people have.
Okay.
Now, to me, that is what it was all about.
Okay.
Now, I don't necessarily have a strong opinion about Vietnam, other than I feel that many people have returned from Vietnam, and their effects were far greater than I could understand of how they returned and how they were unable to cope with life. Even as recent as I was involved in a filming that's taking place beneath the shadow of the blade, that's a documentary that will be coming out, in, I think, this spring. The people that were shooting the film and the directors, you know, were trying to find out why, you know, how did I deal with people when I came home? And I think that's what they had seen or heard about most of, that many vets were unable to cope with life when they came home. And I personally never saw that. I personally used it in, as a growing experience to try and understand people better. And I look at it, as far as the lessons learned, as a positive side of my life. And it's helped me in every opportunity that I've had in life. But I must say that my attitude about life is that if you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror and say, I'm going to have a bad day, that's exactly what you're going to have. I think we all need to get up with a positive attitude and see how we can influence people in a positive way, not in a negative way. And we, people are, that we are talking to, are like mirrors. They respond to the attitude that you're demonstrating. And if you're going to have a bad day, you many times have created that bad day yourself by the attitude that you've displayed, and people have reacted to you in a negative way.
How do you feel after all the thousands of wounded soldiers that you evacuated out of these LZs? How do you deal with all those images? How do you deal with the intensity of combat today? How do you deal with that?
I after just recently, again in the filming, I had people that actually my crew or other crews have dusted off and picked up, and they, and many of them were seriously injured and wounded. But to have people say thank you, and they're crying, is very rewarding. Again, it's selfish. But with our record of saving probably 95%, that's what is published, 95% of every person that was evacuated in Vietnam lived. That's saying a lot.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, the 200 and some odd thousand people that died surely could have been a 500,000 had we not done our job.
Looking back at your Vietnam experience, do you consider that your most important contribution?
Well, I'll take it again. I'll say it this way.
Okay.
My most important contribution to society would be that I was able to be a part of a new family being born, husbands going home to their loved ones, businesses being run by very competent leaders in America's society today. I would say that's my contribution.
Okay.
Or Dustoff's contribution. Or my crew's contribution.
Right.
And I would say that my crew had more effect on that than I did. I just set up the aircraft and pushed the stick. The crew saved the lives.
Yeah, but you had to get that aircraft in there and out of there safely.
And that was a crew. A crew responsibility. And the pilot does have to take it in, but the good pilots will do that, and the good crews will come out alive. And some crews did not make it, and they were good crews. And nothing that they could do could change that. It was just their time to go.
How did you feel in April 1975 when you saw the South Vietnamese government collapse finally?
I was relieved that no one else would have to go.
Okay.
And, you know, my first few thoughts would be, why did we waste so many men and women's lives when we did not want to finish what we started? And I still believe that. I believe that on any encounter that we go into. And that's basically, if you want to get involved, complete the involvement, and then withdraw.
Do you think that's the great lesson of the Vietnam War for the United States government?
Yes.
Do you think the government's learned that lesson?
No. I also think the government will fabricate and build a stage for war. In the military, we don't want war. We're there to prevent war. We're not there to fight wars. If you can understand what I said.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, I do.
We will follow the leadership, and we will do that to the best of our ability. And I think we do have the opportunity to engage in discussion about the overall strategy or the outcomes that might prevail if we get involved. I don't want us to be an isolationist nation. I want us to be free. I want us to be able to fight for freedom and protect America. But I think we can protect America without going to war.
Have you ever been to the Wall in Washington?
Yes.
What was your experience like there?
The Wall is a spiritual experience, and I think that is the most common denominator in most people that see it. Mm-hmm. When I was working as an Army Inspector General in 79 through 81, I was able to get by there when it was finished. Mm-hmm. I don't recall when it was finished, but I've been by there on two occasions. Right after the soldiers that are standing close to the wall was the last time, right after that, was dedicated. It's just, it's a chilling experience. The hair on your body, it's an electrifying experience. Your hair on your body will almost lift up and stand on end. That's my physical experience of it. It's a saddening experience. But the positive side, from our business, we saved more lives in the Vietnam War, and we had the best success of any war ever fought. And that was good.
Yes, sir.
And I think people like Dr. Dean John Buesler, the previous dean of your medical school there, mm-hmm. and him flying with me in Vietnam and working on behalf of the governor of the state of Texas to trying to determine the value of using helicopters in evacuation and rescue missions in the United States was significant. Because we had that all over the United States of America now. Mm-hmm. And I think your institution there was one of the pioneers that did that. Mm-hmm. And that's another positive aspect. And I tell my grandchildren, when I see a helicopter flying patients. That's what your granddad used to do.
Mm-hmm. Would you ever want to go back to Vietnam?
Yes. I've asked Jim that I be one of the members of the team that goes to Vietnam, Canto, wherever. And I would jump at the opportunity of going to Vietnam and assist in your school. Mm-hmm. I'm always trying to campaign here and do that.
Okay.
And especially to Can Tho, where your medical school affiliation is. Mm-hmm. And that's where I evacuated almost every patient that I evacuated on my first tour. And probably some of the children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren that are there in that school today are there because I flew them and our crew flew them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. What do you think about Vietnam, the country, today?
It's still a suppressed country. I'm glad that there are some innovative business people there trying to help the country recover. I think it would be a wonderful tourist place. Again, I think the people could support that quite well, and they'd do a very good job. Vietnam was a beautiful country. I've been in places where probably no American's been. One place I, on several occasions when I was the executive officer for the 61st Med Battalion, I'd carry scrounge medical supplies down to a leprosarium right on the edge of the Red China Sea, south of Quang Tri. Mm-hmm. Quy Nhon, and a visit of a nunnery there that had a leprosarium, and they were very industrious and built absolutely beautiful tile for flooring. Mm-hmm. I wish I could have gotten crates and crates of that stuff home. Just gorgeous artwork that they performed there. Mm-hmm. In their final stages of being a leper. Mm-hmm. And there are other places, small community villages, that compounds that I've walked in after disasters have occurred. And again, how needy those people were, but how resilient they were, because you go there the next week and they look like they were back to a normal schedule, trying to do the best they could, even though they were being beat around the head and shoulders, if they were ever supported by the American government. I would love to go back and maybe even find some people that were there that I saw on a daily basis.
For young people today, what would you teach them about the Vietnam War? What would you tell them about Vietnam?
Don't allow the American government to stage unnecessary a war. That's the only thing that I could say that would probably be repeated by many people.
Mm-hmm. It has been. Is there anything else that you would like to add to our discussions?
No.
Okay. We'll end the interview now. Thank you very much, Colonel Sylvester.